Welcome to LFPL's At the Library series, an ongoing podcast featuring author talks, programs, and events at the Louisville Free Public Library. For more information about upcoming events, visit us online at www.lfpl.org/upcomingevents.htm.
I would like to introduce our presenter, whose name is Gregory Maupin. He is a dear friend of mine. I worked with him for several years with a theater project called L'Epetamane Theater Ensemble, but he has since gone on to do some wonderful things on stage here in Louisville with the Shakespeare Festival, with Actors Theater of Louisville. He is a very funny man. I'll say that. I would imagine he'll say, "Why would you say I'm funny before you get to see?" But he's a lovely human being, so I would like you for you to welcome, please, Gregory Maupin. Gregory Maupin.
The actor's nightmare to find yourself in a play scene with a complete lack of awareness of what the play is, what your lines are, and a deep and anxious feeling of being unprepared. I don't have that anymore. This is ridiculous. My name is Gregory Maupin. I have worked with him doing all kinds of disreputable theatrical things, and Kentucky Shakespeare, and of late I have to leave that on because of the microphone. And of late, Actors Theater of Louisville, frankly, anyone who will hire me. I'm not going to pretend like I'm proud. I would like to. Oh, I've left this. It's going to be too warm for that. I would like to ask if anyone here, as a quick informal poll, has ever failed in some significant way? Just a show of hands. Yes, yes, essentially unanimous. I'd also, I should probably, how many here are still alive? All right. I ask that question, those questions frequently, and almost never do the numbers add up. I'm not sure. I studied, rather than walking back and forth, I'll keep my little notes near. It's fancy, look, technology. Note cards. I studied clown as a form first back at the turn of the century, which is still fun to say, not at a clown college. It's usually the first question. No, yes, there is a thing called Clown College. It's all very exciting. I went to a place that was more like, this is a meaningless thing to anyone in the room, probably but me. But there's circus clown. There's nothing wrong with circus clown. It's just a separate form. And there's what is sort of known as theater clown, which are these people who take things like far too seriously about it and work, and they don't laugh at things. They just go, that's funny. And they nod in a certain a theater person kind of way. And that's the place I went to. It was less of a clown college and more like a clown seminary, which means that it turned out chaplains, I suppose. But it's that sort of thing. It's that the people with doing, you know, bowler derby things. Yes, does that make sense? And I among the thrusts of that program were about how to craft your own performance material, which is very useful because actors. I bill myself sometimes when I do that at all as an actor creator, because one of my old mentors suggested that as a great title for us theatrical hyphenates. Who inevitably, to make a living in the world of the performing arts, you do at least 8 or 9 different aspects of it, just because that allows you to have a paycheck for the entirety of the year. So you become, but then you sound like a pretentious buffoon if you call yourself an actor, director, composer, sound designer, choreographer, dramaturg. You start to sound like you think highly of yourself and not that you will just take whatever someone offers, which is usually the truth. So actor-creator is a nice in-between place as far as pretentious and also accurate, which is what I strive for. I strive for the balance between pretension and accuracy, and I think I'm doing all right. I studied it at a program that taught us how to build our own stuff. Often when you are waiting around for the next job, you can wait around for the next job in theater, pound the pavement. As we used to say in New York, pretension and accuracy. I'm from PRP, if that actually is useful. I didn't answer the prime Louisville question right off. Hi, Greg Maupin, Pleasuridge Park High School. Go. We felt we were better than Valley, at least, I guess. Not going to get distracted into local things, Greg. Don't let yourself do it. Don't go for cheap audience response. Don't do it. Taught us how to build our own stuff, but also how to find, in sort of the clown segment of what we did, what is known in some circles of theater clowning as your personal clown. There are people who feel like, well, put on the big pants, put on the nose, do funny things equals clown. And it is a certain, it's perfectly reasonable to do that as long as it's funny. If it's not funny, don't. That's the only rule, though. Like, it must be actually entertaining, but it doesn't require some deep soul searching. Or there's a version that does require some deep soul searching. That is about finding out what your own foibles is far too dinky a word. But your own foibles, your own failings, your personality dysfunctions that are not, you know, debilitating and therapy requiring necessarily.
I can. Why not?
But also go more deeply into how you fall apart and how you hold it together and that kind of thing. And which is a performance style entirely based in failure and survival. Which is why you get more stuff like, if you're theater watchers or readers at all, you get more of the Beckett Waiting for Godot end of clown out of this, as well as the darker edges of Keaton and Chaplin and all of that stuff. I'm fond of telling students when I do clown-based things to remember that the Wacky Little Tramp was a homeless guy who was entirely impoverished and usually stealing food to stay alive. This beloved comic character that we're all like, oh, it's the funny little guy with the mustache and the little hat and the clothes that don't fit. Why don't his clothes fit? You cry? Because those are the ones he found. It's a horrid, horrifying situation that he is surviving. I also recommend, if you really want to watch him survive at his best, there's a moment in the circus, I think. Yeah, the circus, where he steals food from an infant. It's delightful. We've all wanted to. It's like a baby is on his dad's shoulder with a hot dog, and he's doing what you do, you know, with a baby. And every time the dad turns around, he bites a hot dog, and then steps, and the kid responds, and the dad turns around, which is cute and also awful in the way that good comedy gets a bad rap. It's Oscar season, and all of the people who get nominated for things, you know, cried their way there. Bless their hearts. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's respectable, but there's always this sort of lack of respect given to the depth possible. You know, you've seen the comedy that has stuck with you in some way, that you think of when you're at your worst moments, not as a relief, but as a recognition. I remember hearing somewhere that lions, it was an animal, a behavioral person, that lions smile. I mean, I wouldn't want to be near just because I'm not entirely sure what the body language is when the teeth come out of a lion. But that lions and other big cats will smile in a thing that is recognizably a smile when they recognize things. And that the thought is that that is actually the basis of this nonsense, that laughter is about recognition. Other elements come into it too. Surprise. But recognition is a vitally important part of it, in that when you see someone do something ridiculous, the likelihood is that you too are capable of being a pitiful, ridiculous failure. I hope. I would hate to think that anyone in here is not capable of that. I don't know any of those people. And you discover when you're dealing with the sort of personal clown stuff. I love talking like super seriously about comedy stuff because it doesn't make any sense. And every now and again, you get that, you see that camera, you have that out of body moment. No, there's an old, comedy truism. I forget exactly. If I thought harder, and I'm not going to waste your time because that would take a while, about who it was. But, speaking of comedy is like dissecting a frog. In that you will, by the end, know how it works, but you will be left poking a dead frog, which is no one's idea of a good time. No matter, back to the school, no matter the personal nature of the failings that you find as you try to seek them in comic stuff, you discover that there's a room full of people with the same failings, with the same nerves, with the same fears, more or less, and you fall into slightly different categories, but you think yourself, we always think ourselves like at those awful low moments. Not that anyone's had any of those in the last couple of years, but of like, no, it's just me. It's just me. I am alone in this, whatever this is for you. And that sense that it is never takes a lot of effort to discover that you are not that weird, insular, strange, idiosyncratic failing that you have is inevitably shared by probably 35% of the population. 33% of the population. Well, I say that more specifically because another thing we learned, though they didn't put it in these terms, was that more or less the clown personalities that we would each fall into more or less resemble the Three Stooges. Not that specifically, but clown types sort of clump together because if you have siblings, my wife is one of three, and they very much fall into this. This just sort of happens. The sort of oldest, middle, youngest, we're all some version of that. Whether you're from a houseload of siblings or not, there's that fascist who wants order, and there is that force of chaos who wants only to make order impossible for everyone around them. And there's that little sort of manipulative one in the middle who seems perhaps less of a strong personality, but is very frequently starting things and backing away. And just about every clown personality ends up falling into that. without any effort. That just sort of happens. You discover that depending on the person around you, it does change in relativity. I have my own fascistic tendencies that tend to work around little chaotic people that I have to hold still. But in the right, there's someone worse than me out there. And I would be the little manipulative instigator in relativity to them, if any of that makes sense. Oh, the depth of insular clown training. And this is, I should note the European clown tradition. There are lots of variants on this over the globe, but this is from how it works coming out of that European clown tradition. It's trickling down out of, you know, crazy Italian masked people and all. And I say that because even though this is a European thing I'm talking about, the clown does not exist in a vacuum. Partially because they're so small vacuums that a clown can't really get anything effective done in a vacuum. That's for my entertainment. We're more likely to see them, this kind of clowning, in like a circus context. You think of it as, even if you're seeing the serious clown I'm talking about, you think of it as a circus act. You think of the circus, you think of tricks. You think of people doing extravagant tricks for your delight and being quite good at them, skilled above the center ring without a net, etc. And then you see the clown that comes in between, and the clown has been presented in the same way as the flying Bulldonis, but they fail at a remarkably simple task. I mean, that's the basics of how a clown bit works, is you set up something simple, having prepared some note cards, being on stage when you're announced instead of sitting in the wrong place, like small little bits, or whatever your usual clown, you know, bucket of confetti stuff is. I should say that I say you think of it, and I assume you think of it in a circus context and not in a lazy horror movie context. I have things I will not say about that whole thing. People who have replaced, in lieu of a personality, they've decided to be afraid of clowns. He said, jadedly and jaundiced. But if you watch a person in front of you at a circus, in any performance context, your assumption is that what they're doing, they are doing on purpose. Until they foolishly let you know otherwise. So to see someone attempt something, a simple-looking thing, and then fail at it is, ideally, a surprise. Surprise and recognition, we'll say. The things that inspire laughter in us, or tend to, at a basic level. And especially if they fail in surprising ways, you can, of course, fail in just a fairly, I almost said jejune, but I'll say simple or pedestrian way, because I don't want to get fancy. It's 7 o'clock already. I mean, our minds can only take so much after dinner. To fail in interesting or surprising ways is then the goal. The paradox, of course, being that failing in a way that is inevitable and that you see coming a mile away can also be delightful if you build the tension properly, you know. But that's for clown class. Circus is, of course, a much later thing. I say, you know, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's there's a world tradition of Loki and Coyote and who else? Eshu, Hermes, Krishna, Bugs Bunny. The trickster notion, the idea that there is someone who exists on the boundaries and is chaotic and is making things move forward. You go back into older world religions and myths, there's inevitably the trickster. There's inevitably the shaman or something like that, who is responsible for order and keeping things going properly and making some nice rules, which are incredibly useful to get us through our days and our lives and our societies. But however, occasionally to make things move, to kick the dust off of order and shake it out a little bit, there must be someone tippy-toeing around the boundaries. There must be someone like that. And you get your trickster tradition. And the clown sort of trickles down from all of that. So many of those old stories are still applicable in a making up a dumb bit to do in front of people context. Like, it's all, the difference is minimal. The dad joke that you think is hundreds of years old is probably in fact thousands of years old. I can only imagine, like, all of us around campfire together at some point and fingers being pulled, you know? And I have to assume that tradition goes back into the caves, you know? The farts are funny, inevitably, depending on the people who think they're coarse and they find it a little shameful, but they're the people who make it funny. This is a new thought, because even regardless of the society, it's unpleasant. It's publicly a bit embarrassing, even in more forgiving places. Wherever that imaginary place is, my dad would always tell us about after dinner, it's like, well, in some places it's rude. It's rude not to burp, you know, after dinner. I don't know where that is. I still haven't found out. I've looked for that trait in a society. I have not found it. I don't mistrust my father, however, I'm sure it's out. But that public, which becomes rarer and harder to get to in our wonderful, the loosey-goosiness of our own society now, the sort of like, well, many things are far more accepted and we're giving people less of a hard time about things that used to be like very rigidly Victorian, you know, which means that it's harder to come up with someone to poke fun at in that way, that rigid person, that the Margaret Dumont, if any of you know Marx Brothers movies, there's always that sort of person who thinks everything should be very serious that is like, oh, good, ammo, and they will run up and mock the surroundings of that person. And it gets you have to hunt for new people taking themselves too seriously, which is what keeps it vibrant, I guess. Part of I think failure's usefulness in all this is because, I won't do the informal poll again, but you know that your failures stick with you. You remember your successes, you have your pride, but the moments of, perhaps I am projecting, the moments of feeling like you have made a public ass of yourself are implanted, imprinted, you know, deeply, regardless of whether they happened in young childhood or 6 weeks ago, you get the flushed memory, the actor's nightmare, everyone, other normal people's version of the actor's nightmare, that sense of public unpreparation. I suppose a normal person's version of the actor's nightmare is that back at school in your underwear dream that everyone always sort of jokes about, but like it's a funny because of recognition. Yes. I remember, for example, being in the place, I can hear the tones of voice of some of the mentors of this place where I studied, saying to us on a Friday afternoon, to me and my little group of creators in particular, for example, his voice was very nasal. I'm going to do it accurately, and you can possibly appreciate it because you don't know the man. The amount by which you missed the boat was stellar. And he meant every word of that with deep love, because we had done something very stupid and poorly conceived. And that moment of failure that we all felt, because it was early on, and when the person, like, hi, I am a respected artist with my genius grant or whatever, and to tell you, like, you're wrong, wildly wrong. And after a couple of breaths, which was, he began to tell us about how much love he had for a good, bold failure, because it is far more interesting to watch than a safe success. This may not be true in all walks of life. I don't know. I don't have an effective eye for people in other walks of life because I haven't had any reasonable ones. But the bold failure is very frequently more, you'll get, someone will get more out of it. Perhaps it will be you. Perhaps it will be someone else. Stage failure, I think, saved my life once from an absolute heart attack many years ago when I was much younger and there was hair here and it made it reasonable for me to play the younger of the two men in the four-person play Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's a large play, if you don't know it. It's a long play. It's a mouthy play. A lot of words. Most of those words go to the couple that is the lead. Significantly fewer go to the couple that sits and watch them yell at each other. I oversimplify and more things happen, but mostly you watch them yell at each other. That's all you need to know for the purposes of this. The young woman gets ill and the older woman takes her off into, well, I was going to say the bathroom. She didn't go to a bathroom. They went into the wings off stage. They didn't go anywhere. They're pretending it's a show. I'm there in the bar, in the living room of their house, and I watch the man with all the lines playing a role named George. I listen to George bounce from a monologue in the midst of Act One to a monologue in the midst of Act Three and back again, and I see the two little beads of sweat that are trickling down his temple, and I know all is not right. There's very little I can do to fix that. And he improvises. Edward Albee, as a playwright, was very strict about people messing with his words. But this actor did so. He said, "I'm going to go see how the girls are doing." And he left me there alone on stage. He knew that there was a copy of the script in the wings, offstage right, which mercifully was also where the bathroom had been established to be. So he went that way. He looked at me and I don't know if I could call it an apologetic eye, but just a, this is the way it is. And he walked away. When I was very young, seventh, eighth grade, for reasons I do not understand even now, except for that local television was different then in those days of early basic cable, I watched a lot of sitcoms from the 1950s and 60s. I'm glad I did. They taught me a lot about all this stuff that I'm talking about. I still swear by several of them today. If you can watch any episodes of The Dick Van Dyke Show or Sergeant Bilko, they're still quite funny in surprising ways that you don't expect. That's funny. It didn't date. Who knew? Others don't. I used to watch The Honeymooners a lot. That was the prime moment of they had just found the lost episodes of The Honeymooners. 39 episodes of The Honeymooners had been shown over and over again for 40 years, or maybe 30 years at that point. And they had suddenly found this trove of old kinetoscopes of the, and I did a book report on them in the eighth grade. It's nonsense, the level of interest that I had in this. So I read a story in reading one of several books I read, I say this in front of a crowd of adults, about The Honeymooners, about the work, the oeuvre of Jackie Gleason. On live television in the mid-1950s, Jackie Gleason left the stage to do whatever he was scripted to do in the bedroom that you never saw away from the Cramden's kitchen living one-room area. And in their Bensonhurst cold water flat, and he walked off, and he got distracted somehow. He was producing the show. Someone asked him a question. It took longer than it was supposed to. Live television, three, maybe four channels. No, Dumont was gone by then. At most, you got three channels, so a lot of people are watching. Millions upon millions. This was not, you know, the fractured streaming day. And Art Carney was on live television. Alone, but he was in character, and his character was a freeloading neighbor, and a freeloading neighbor left alone in a friend's kitchen after an awkward amount of time, goes to the fridge. For some reason, there was an orange in the refrigerator. So he sat at the kitchen table on live television. It probably didn't take as long as it is taking me to tell you this. And very carefully, in a bit that his character had of excessive, like, you know, shooting his cuffs, you know, out of the sleeves that he was not wearing, and prepared and meticulously and hilariously peeled this orange. I heard that story when I was 12. Other 12-year-olds were doing normal things. I don't know. I was staying up late Sunday nights listening to Dr. Demento and ruining my life because leaving me with only the option you see before you. And for some reason, though I had not thought of that story in a dozen years, I remembered that story as I watched George's back head that way. And there was a fully stocked bar and a desk. So I went to the desk. I opened it. There were some papers in there. I didn't have a medicine cabinet. What are you going to do, right? And I poured myself another drink. That's all the time he was gone. That was it. Nothing crazy happened. He was gone for 45 seconds, top, which anyone who's ever been on stage before will tell you is an eternity. Especially in a famous play where perhaps a few people in the audience might have thought, I don't remember a scene where Nick is just on stage alone. This is a bold staging choice. But as I said before, if you do it in front of everyone, on a stage, in a context, in a center ring, whatever, they presume this is happening on purpose until you tell them the truth, which is never a good idea. Even when something happens that is beyond your control, the scenery falls. Two different actors that I know, twice, if you've ever been to see Kentucky Shakespeare in Central Park, there are dogs. There are always dogs. It's a park. Two different actors in different seasons. Dogs have walked up onto the stage, delighted at what they see going on, and have simply picked up the dogs and walked off when it was time to go. And people love it. It's not a deeply creative solution. It is a necessary solution. And the fact that you could not have planned that gives the audience such joy. I'm pretending it's part of the show. In one case, there was dancing going on, and he tried to get the dog to dance and hoped to hold it for the curtain call. Christian Wiltshire, I'll say him by name, because he had hoped to be able to bow with the dog for cheap applause. He admitted it freely. Like, oh, yeah, no, I was going to get a surge of applause because I got the cute doggy in my hand. But the dog ran backstage. It was fine. I say all of those things. I don't think. Now, I did that show in 1999. I went to the turn of the century. Since the turn of the century, I have not had the actor's nightmare. I have had actor annoyance dreams. Like, I don't know what the show is. I don't know what the lines are. Well, hell, okay, now what? Well, we'll do something. I've had the dream, weirdly, but it has ceased to be a nightmare. It has ceased to be an anxiety thing. And I place that entirely on the fact that I was taught a version of theater in adulthood that was based in failure, that was based in almost. You have to be very careful. Actors are a superstitious lot, and I've been in enough productions of Macbeth to know that. That you're sort of quietly hoping something to go wrong. You build in the little spots when you're building your own show. That's like, well,
if anything goes wrong here,
I know a way that I could maybe. And then you sort of try to draw the foul, as it were. You're like, oh, well, just walk. But this guy looks like trouble in the audience, for example. I will engage this person to entice them into making a problem out of themselves so I can deal with it. And it's delightful. And an audience loves it because there's a fine line between no one likes audience participation. I may ask for some later. No one likes it. I don't expect you to like it. I don't like it either. It's just a thing that happens. Partially because there is no way to succeed at audience participation. It is always a failure because if you choose the person who really wants to do it, you must never choose the person who really wants to do it. If you choose a person who would be a reasonable human being about it, probably, they're terrified. They're just wetting themselves just a little, and they're like aggressively averting their eyes from you unless they're deer in headlight, utterly tharn, as they say in Watership Down. And then you may mistake that for an interest in coming up on stage. It's very difficult to be like, okay, you have too much excitement. You are terrified. Well, you're in between them. Like, that's the poor person who happens to be sitting near those people ends up getting yanked up on stage. Unless it's Blue Man Group, in which they look for a person who is tall and bald, as I discovered once when I went to see Blue Man Group. Someone who looks like one of them. Slightly less blue. I don't. The broken prop, the unreliable stage partner, the weirdo who you thought would be a good idea to bring up on stage, the running dog, has ceased to be a sense of anxiety. However, I have found, and I feel like this, as failure goes, I have found that when you say out loud to the universe that you're hoping for something kooky to happen, when someone asks you what you do, and you say, I work in, you try not to say clown, because there's a whole conversation that happens when you tell people, oh, I do a lot of clown work. And it's usually not a conversation. We all have those little, like, it's not dishonesty, but it's like, I'm gonna say something slightly else. I work in physical comedy, because that's the clearest thing to say. Like, it's the thing I teach when I teach. It's the thing I usually get cast to do in some way. So I'm an actor, I work in physical comedy. And every time I say that, within 24 hours, something occurs. As if I have said to the universe, I am a clown. And the universe says, oh. And I then find that I have got this strap to my bag caught on the doorknob in an utterly implausible but clearly physically possible way that I would try with all my might to choreograph if I were doing a thing, but I'm not doing a thing. I'm late for work. The shirt has been with me for a long time and has a clown history with me that it doesn't matter to you. But my old clown mentor was very much, he had this preternatural sense of picking up on our vanities. The things that make you concerned in a way that you really would rather someone didn't say, hey, you know what I think you're self-conscious about? I don't want to talk about it. He said 20 years ago when I was lither than I am now, was like, clowns, they do require an outfit. They need the rumple. They need the something that gives them a silhouette. And you need a tummy. Not like a, you don't need to be like a big, Oliver Hardy. You just need like a little pillow. Just a pillow in the front of the pants. Just tuck it in. It's a tummy. And I'm like, despite youth and skinniness, you're still self-conscious. It's a socially self-conscious region, this right here is. Then I had, this is a funny story. I had major abdominal surgery about 5 years ago in which they had to, slice all the muscles of the wall to get in. It's lots of fun. And while the internal stuff seems to have been a breeze, the external stuff is like, oh, it hurts. It's the part, the weird question mark of a scar I have, like the Riddler did my surgery. And now it's very difficult, no matter how much exercise, that's a lie. I don't do near enough. Age also causes this, but like I have watched, even as I am fitter in other ways, thank you, yoga, with Adrian. Thank you for getting me through the pandemic. This won't firm up. My clown teacher knew somehow. Like this was here when I started it. Like this is the longest my hair's been in many years. It's this is what has occurred. This is how it grows and doesn't grow. This is the pattern it chose. At some point, I said aloud to the universe, I'm a clown. And the universe said, all right, I'm going to give you bozo pattern baldness. It is what you get. Deeper back than that, the clown, sideline from a sideline, the clown knows, with which we are all familiar, sorry, repositional trouble. The clown knows is a little sort of evolution from an old mask from the Italian Commedia. Most of the masks were here across the front of the face, but there was one that was the doctor, the dottore, generally overweight, wearing an academic gown, babbling and eating and drinking profusely. The dottore was the academic ne'er-do-well who talked and talked and talked in highfalutin Latinate words, and then also took advantage of other people's generosity whenever he could, or just took it from them when they weren't looking. Back to Chaplin's hot dog. And he wore a mask that was the top of the head, that was a bald top of the head with a ring of hair around it that went down to this nose. And it was painted in what I suppose would be kindly called wine blossoms. Yes, you know, the wine-stained broken capillaries of purple sometimes these masks were, because there's exaggeration, that somehow eventually over the ages shrunk down to a little red nose, which is much easier to deal with than this whole thing. So even this is historically deeper into clown than I had ever expected to go. I didn't expect it to become genetic. These are the tricks the universe plays. Would anyone care? I swear this is gentle. Would anyone care to join me up here for a moment? All I'm going to ask you to do, there's no performance involved in this. It's an academic exercise. In fact, I would ask no one to perform. If anyone would be so kind as to just stand here for a moment, I'd like you to take two steps forward. It's just a, yeah, sure, all right. That's all I'm asking. I'll stay away from you. I would like to add one thing to that, however. When you step forward, it's important to realize that walking, you probably knew this, but I'll tell them, walking is a failed faceplant. To walk is to fall down. The bravery of the tiny children. To walk is to fall face first on the ground, except that you put your foot down at the last moment. So what I would like you to do is take a step forward. You give yourself some room. Step back here. By just let yourself, please, I'm not insured, so be careful. Let yourself fall forward and stop yourself with your foot. That's the kind of step I mean. It's just no fun if I do. There, a step. A failed fall. Now, would you do it one more time? It was fine. It was all right. I was looking very closely. Now, most people, if they find themselves about to fall face first on the ground, will scream blue murder because they do not want that to happen. So all I ask is that as you fall, please, it's an abyss before you, you know. I don't know how far away that is. So just scream uncontrollably until such time as you realize that your foot will save your life, and let it save your life. Thank you. Thank you. Well done. You may take your seat. It's been a pleasure. Every step that we take is a potential horrible failure. And in fact, then we fail at that. Every success is a failure to fail, in a way, which is an important paradox for a clown. Because there's an inherent theatricality that we have. Would two other people come up, actually? Unplanned thought. Just two people, just to stand here. Or actually just one other person. I could be the number two. Just to stand here. I swear you don't even have to do as much as that. I'm literally asking you to stand just in a different place from where you're sitting. Anyone? It requires no, we've got one. It's difficult because you're the worst example in the room. This will make itself sensible in a moment. There is a thing, there's a concept, you'll know what I'm gonna say, that is inherent theatricality, which is to say that we're not going to do anything here. And yet a story is already told because you have looked at us. You have seen us. You have seen our relative heights. You have seen our relative builds. Unfortunately, we are. It's not that far, right? But you see, thank you, Tony, for squatting. But you see a couple of people together, and already something has occurred. You don't have to make you. If I'm up here and a tiny little old lady is up here, and I punch her in the face, an audience has an immediate response that it's going to take some storytelling to get them to change their opinion of. Maybe she had it coming, but that's not important. If all other things being equal, there's a little old bicardiganed lady. It's a word. And in her 90s, and me, and I walk up and punch her in the face, seemingly unprompted. You have an opinion, and part of that opinion is not because of the violence, but because of us, because of me, and because of her. If the opposite occurs, you also have an opinion. If a little old lady walks up to me and punches me in the face unprompted, seemingly, you have an opinion about what has occurred, and very little story has been told. If we simply stand next to each other for a time, you fill in a lot of blanks, which is a useful thing to me, to the importance of casting, to know about how when you're building things to keep the interest in those things, is to know how much an audience has already done. I say that about, you know, they've come to the circus, they have expected a trick to be done, and when you do the trick, it's successfully or failed, they, depending on how you play off the failure, then understand it to be you tell them what the rules are, and they will expect you to obey them. There is a certain amount of perseverance, for example, in the face of failure that a clown has, that a normal actor who's just trying to get through a nice show with a nice script by somebody or another, they're going to be able to tell when that goes off the rails. Whereas when you've come up and you have a little glint of chaos in your eye and a bucket of paint, then they're going to assume that you're going to persevere much longer than seems sane with trying to clean up your mess and only making more mess as you go. They're going to gauge in a performance, you know, in the context of I'm up here, you're out there. They're going to gauge it very differently. And failing to recognize that is the only real failure that I can think of that would happen up here. Failing to realize that the audience has done a certain amount of work for you, that they have an expectation that you, just by showing up, a promise has been made that you must fulfill or circumnavigate in a way that pleases them or whatever your clever, don't say clever, rabbit is clever. No, Pooh is probably the better person to use as an example here. But whatever your means are of figuring out the success, the permutations of failure that you're allowed to give to them. Comedy, it has been said by many people, has the rule of three. Yes, you're familiar possibly with the rule of three. One, two, it's got to happen three times for things to be properly funny. You got to establish that there's a thing that's happening. You do it a second time, it becomes a pattern. The third time, you do something different, it breaks. That is why, you know, a rabbi and a priest and a Protestant deacon walk into that bar. That is why they're on that lifeboat. It requires three of them. And it doesn't matter the order, and it doesn't matter who's the one who breaks the pattern. It doesn't matter, you know, where those three guys from Indiana or Tennessee or Blazer Ridge Park happen to be. You know, it's the same thing all over the world. The same things exist. But there have to be three of them for that basic reason. If there are seven of them, I don't want to sit through this guy's joke. I'm leaving the bar myself. I don't want to hear about these. The seven guys on a lifeboat. Oh God. I
I say that. That's probably not true. I would probably stick around out of curiosity and my own unfortunate politeness that has never served me in good stead. But it's also, there is a concept that came out of traditional Japanese theater that crept out of the theater into various Eastern philosophies, that of jo-ha-kyu, which is almost the same thing as the rule of threes when telling a joke. That you begin, that there's a break, and that there's a speeding up again, and you begin a new move, and there's a break, and there's a speeding up again, and this pattern, which was meant, a theater philosopher, you know, in ancient Japan, came up with this notion to say, well, there are ways that you build a show, that the show should have this rhythm of the jo, the ha, and the kyu. And also that each breath you take has that rhythm, and that a human's life could be said to have that rhythm, and a scene in a play, and a moment in a play, a gesture, and the play itself all have that rhythm. The notion being that the rule of threes, that the rabbi, the priest, and the deacon are inherent in the universe. That nature itself has comedy's patterns. I, my wife and I, are lovers of old movies. It goes past the honeymooners, I swear. And we're far more sophisticated now. And a few years ago, out at Stony Brook, I think it was, they used to do these Tuesday matinees where they would bus in people from seemingly from like convalescent homes, like big busloads of very, very old people. Who would come in, who, because they're the only people who were interested in seeing this sort of not even the high dollar, you know, Hitchcock. It was just whatever old movie they had a copy of. And it was $5 and you get some popcorn and a Coke for that $5. And it was great. So we go and we're just going to go because this sounds good. And I've never seen it. It was a Western from the late 40s called Yellow Sky. Gregory Peck, I think, Ann Baxter, Richard Widmark, 20th Century Fox. We went to see it and it sounded like fun. And we get there, and we are the youngest people there by a good 30 years. And those people are the care tenders for the people who have come to see the movie. Like, this is the audience for the movie. Now, I have a long history, as many do, with going to theater and going to movies. And no matter how empty the house is, whether I am performing or whether I am trying to sit and watch, two little old ladies come in, and they sit right behind me, or right in front of me, or right next to me. In an empty theater, they come and they sit next to me, and they narrate it. I affectionately call them Nana and Rose, because of a pair that I actually encountered once. And they will. It's all the stuff that you very clearly can see happen. Rose, she's smoking a cigarette. He has a gun, Rose. Yes, he does. It's not a real gun. It's a show. And they, if there are movie theater, they will read whatever's on the screen. Jimmy Stewart's in this. Yes, it's Vertigo. It's very famous that Jimmy Stewart is in this. Inside, I'm saying inside. Sometimes I'm clutching my wife's hand until it's numb. I even bought at one point one of the little kindergarten teacher things you get at the Target dollar spots. It's quiet. Little sign on a tongue depressor. I've never had the cojones to use it on someone because I feel bad. And then it'll start a whole conversation, and I don't want conversation. I want the movie. So we went to see Yellow Sky with like a convention of Nana and Rose. But when that's going to happen, like you lean into it. It's like, well, that's the part of the deal. So we're sitting in what feels like the center of the house, surrounded. And they come riding into the ghost town. And there's a big banner that has fallen down, that was hanging across the main street, and it has fallen down. And it says, Yellow Sky, fastest growing town in the territory. And it is hanging down. And I kid you not, every other human in that room read aloud at full voice, Yellow Sky, fastest growing town in the territory. As if it were rehearsed, as if I was raised Catholic, and it felt like that. it had the feeling of the litany being recited by people who were expecting to come and say, yellow sky, fastest growing town in the territory. Adventures occur. 20 minutes later, the gunfighters leave by night. They cross the center main strip of the ghost town again, and about half of the people, slightly quieter, because it's nighttime, read aloud, yellow sky, fastest growing town in the territory, on the off chance that the ghost town's fallen sign had been changed. More movie occurs. Ann Baxter, her father. It's good stuff. It's a decent Western. We go back again, fairly near the end of the movie. This is all, I cannot stress to you how enough that this is true. And one guy at the back of the house, fully allowed, as if perhaps he thought everyone was going to do it with him and they betrayed him. Why aren't you, with a tone that said to me, why aren't you all reading? Yellow sky, fastest growing town in the territory. And Abigail and I collapsed. Partially because it was funny, but partially because we knew how funny it was. The timing of it, the three, the perfection that it offered us felt like a gift from whatever Thalia, the muse of laughter, whatever part of the universe wanted us to feel joy in this thing that annoys the hell out of me 90% of the time, felt like one of the best things that could happen. I'm not sure where it falls in this because I haven't thought about it, but this is my PowerPoint, Tony. The permutations of failure. Yeah, that's why I did it. See, comedy. Better comedy would be me blinking at you as if I were unaware of why you were chuckling. Failure, success, failure, success, failure, success, failure, failure, success, failure, success, 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 failure, failure, success, success, failure, failure, failure. This is the dicey one. Success, success, success. That's when played right, that third success becomes a sort of a failure. Because when they're watching you and they expect you in a clown context to fail all the time, when you succeed, it's very confusing to them and to you. Ideally, the perfect spiritually clown moment is the one where the clown keeps trying to do a somersault. And fails at a somersault. He fails. He can't quite manage to get the somersault to work. He fails. A few minutes later, after doing some other things, he sees an opportunity and he fails. He stands and looks at the floor, looking for something else to blame other than himself. Someone comes up behind him and says, hey! He does a double backflip, lands on his feet, and is very angry at that person, thinks for a second, decides to put it away, and continues to yell at this person. That is the perfect success in a clown world, if that makes sense. I would happily have demonstrated it for you, but I cannot do that. But the clown requires the failure to entertain, to bond, to inspire the recognition, which is what makes the failure a necessary part, the necessary part of this kind of performance. I'll go back to Jejun and say the sine qua non. I took Latin once. Of clown and so that failure is an absolute requirement for success as a clown, which is weird, which I fully accept that the only way you can live in the stress of that paradox is that doing a thing badly and spending a lot of time figuring out, there was an old exercise we used to do called the hassle, which is where we'd take like, I don't know, a sweatshirt, whatever, and spend minutes doing it wrong. We would be given something and we would have to find a way to spend as much time as possible not, oh, the lining is changing, is Yeah, to find as much time as possible, not getting it where it needs to be. None of that was funny. I have higher standards. What I will not make you sit through is we would do that half an hour until you reach a breaking point, an absolute breaking point, where you have failed to fail sufficiently or interestingly or whatever. And in doing that, finally, at some point, your breaking point, you get through, and that is when either something comes to you, or more frequently, you stop trying, and it goes wrong anyway. It is essentially the weird paradox of me trying to do in a rehearsal room what I constantly am trying to avoid doing every moment I'm not in the rehearsal room. Every time I have inadvertently tied my shoelace around my finger or whatever other nonsense of which I'm capable, which is a significant amount of nonsense, all of it personally unwanted, but that at a certain point in life, you realize is hilarious. The bottomless pit that you emotionally at some point in your life feel like you're falling down turns out to have mirrored walls. So it provides entertainment for you as you fall, because you know what is hilarious looking? This! And the mental health difference that I have had in being in doing this as a perfectionist, as a youthful, you know, I can't overestimate, because I am still vain. Not about this, I gave up on that, but I still have my particular vanities, but they're far more easygoing now. Or when I see them, I can lean into them and mock them myself. They haven't stopped happening. I have not become, despite what you see before you, perfect. But but there is a real sense, having accepted that my livelihood depends on the parts of me that I would most like to just excise and get rid of, the habits. And then having to dance in there, as one of my old other of my many mentors would say, find the problem and live in it for a while. And it all sounds very simple. It all sounds very like, oh, sure, yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I'm clumsy, right? And I cannot stress how not simple it was, how much weeping there was on behalf of all of us as we went through this, usually not in the room, usually later. And theater people, the propensity to weep is, you know, it's a thin skin. Thin skin is one of the prerequisites for the business. And yet also an ability to handle all kinds of rejection. So it doesn't make any sense. Nothing about it makes any sense. But outside of clown, I think that failure is just as vital an element of success. Without the F's, you will not S. And if you do S without the F, then I question whether you learned how it worked, the thing that you S'd at. Or possibly someone else did all of the work and you weren't even paying attention to that fact and you just sort of took the S. And someone else did all the effing work, and then you didn't really yes now, did you? In summation, I will say something about Shakespeare, having worked in that as well, which feels so very different from like wacky make 'em up clown work to doing like 400-year-old texts that some people know by heart and will recognize if you get wrong in front of them. So there's only about 10 lines they know by heart, and they'll go along. But there is so much failure in all creative plot work. No good story that you've ever read is not fraught with failure. It would be very short and dull if people behaved properly. You know, no one wants to watch like the happy Macbeth couple just go like, well, you know, he's a good king. I'm all right. You're not going to pay $20 to get in to see that and stay there the whole time. But speaking it, doing it, not just the plots, obviously, but doing it is a matter of is saying out loud something that everyone thinks of as glorious poetry. But you have to fail to let it do that. You have to fail to be poetic, because if you're poetic, it falls asleep. Everyone falls immediately asleep because it's boring. And yeah, it's true. And there's a necessity of making it sound like a human being speaking, just a person who's very, very good at speaking, which is not you. It's whoever, you know, whoever wrote the thing down. And failing to know what comes next. To know everything cold, the general act, this isn't just Shakespeare, but it's a little trickier in Shakespeare, but to know everything that you're going to do and to know it cold and to still seem as if you are winging it. To have what back in acting one they called the illusion of the first time, where you can do this for many nights in a row and can also seem as if this has never happened before and you don't know what you're going to say next. But also not to just stutter and pause until everyone also then goes home, because there's only so much of that they could take. these characters are unprepared people, muddling along eloquently, muddlingly in the tragedies, but particularly in the comedies, because comedy, Shakespeare or otherwise, is so much about bending and popping back, the tree in the wind, as it were, not the tree that snaps. The tragedy tree is the tree that snaps and gets hit by lightning and falls to the ground. Comedy is not death. It's impossible resurrection under ridiculous circumstances. It's one of the reasons, I thought this morning, it's one of the reasons that authoritarians historically, I don't know of the several silent comedies that Tony put over there, and I don't know if the library has a copy of The Great Dictator, but it's a delightful thing to watch right about now. A Chaplin movie about 1940, before America joined World War II. Fascinating movie. It's why authoritarians hate comedy so much, because to understand laughter is to know that we are all potentially ridiculous. And to fear your own demise just a little bit less, because everybody, you know? And I am not making light of the world situation when I say that when I note that a former stand-up comedian is currently the person who is standing up to one of the world's largest dictators at the moment. And the part that I mean when I say I'm not making light of this is that if anyone is prepared for a situation like that, for the emotional situation like that, I don't know about the strategics, but the emotional situation like that, if anyone is prepared, it is a guy who has played like whatever the Ukrainian equivalent of the Wednesday night open mic is. Like, that's hard on your soul. And to be able to stand up in a moment of bravery, yes, but to train for that, I think he was trained as effectively as a person can be for his constitution was tested by that. So winding up, self-confidence in what I do for a living has been the simple act of making failure a part of the process and a part of the product. This is not, as I think I said, a blithe, easy statement. It can involve facing heartbreaking truths about yourself and your vanity and the insecurities that that it stems from, and your lack of control. How did I not notice the dog? How is that possible? What a good dog. I'm preternaturally like zoned in on dogs. That was remarkable. But without getting all woo-woo, it is a I think a sacred brand of of spiritual poverty when it's done properly. And that sounds very, when I say it out loud, ludicrously self-important, but not untrue. I'm going to have to learn that's fine. But how do you fall apart? And how do you hold together? And how are you willing to be unprepared, unqualified, unsuccessful until? And what, when you are left with nothing, you juggle. What's left around? You probably all know the old Zen master story of the farmer whose horse runs off the thing, and the people are like, "Oh God, that's terrible, terrible, bad luck." And he says, "We'll see." And the horse comes back and brings three wild horses along with it, incredibly valuable. "Oh, that's magnificent. How have the gods have favored you? We'll see." And the next day, his son climbs up on one of the unbroken wild horses. It throws him. He shatters the bones in his left leg. "Oh my God, how will you survive? He's your only hand on the farm. What will you do? This is terrible." "We'll see." The next day, the military press gang comes looking for men to conscript, and they pass over his son because his leg's not working at the moment. He says, "Oh my goodness, oh, you dodged a bullet that time, possibly literally." And he says, "We'll see." Or if you want a shorter, a pithier version, Orson Welles said, "If you want a happy ending, it depends, of course, on where you stop telling the story." I'm going to stop telling the story now. Unless anyone has any questions or comments or thoughts, I will bid you all good evening. Thank you. Thank you so much.